Hey, what's up? This is Matt Leslie, writer of Summer of 84 and the new film Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey 2, and you're listening to the Don't Go Out There podcast.
In a world where zombies, ghosts, serial killers, and vampires all exist, it's Nico, Brian, Mike, and Dustin, and they are all that stand between you and the films that could end the world. Welcome to the Don't Go Out There Horror Movie Podcast.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Don't Go Out There Horror Movie Podcast. Just want to thank all our fans and listeners. Really appreciate the support. I'm super excited for this upcoming interview. This is going to be awesome. Please welcome The Hive. You see what I did there? The hive mind behind the upcoming Winnie the Pooh Blood and Honey 2. Director, writer, Reese Frank Waterfield. Writer, Matt Leslie. And producer, Christopher Robin himself, Mr. Scott Chambers. Reese, how are you doing? How are y'all doing?
Yeah, I'm doing really well, thanks. How about you?
Wonderful, wonderful, guys. I really appreciate you guys' time. And let's just get started. Tell us right off the bat, what got you guys wanting to go in this business, whether it's producing, acting, writing? What lit that fire for you guys? Reese, you want to kick us off?
Yeah, sure, yeah. So, yeah, I had a pretty, like, unconventional entry into the industry. I was doing something really, like, techie and a bit boring before, a lot of corporate work. And then, yeah, I saw how much, like, fun Scott was having with filmmaking. So I decided to like throw my hat in the ring, kind of jump in and see what it was like. And that was like 3 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then it was you.
Yeah. and then I saw Scream when I was about 6 years old, 7 years old, something like that. And it really started something for me. Like I just thought it was so freaking cool. And by the time I was about 10, I was using my dad's like big home video recorder, and I was Sidney Prescott, and I was making my own horror films, so it was pretty cool. And but no, seriously though, like yeah, I've just been making films literally since I was about 10, and then I wanted to just focus on the acting, but you know, between jobs it's so difficult, and I just can't sit still, so I just started making my own films. And from there, like, I was lucky to get distribution, and it kept building and building and building, and then Winnie the Pooh happened, and now in the sequel, I'm producing and acting.
Nice. Matt?
So for me, I kind of had an unconditional, untraditional approach to getting into the business too. A long time ago, I moved to LA following my wife out there. Didn't really know much about the business, and I just kind of, you know, was always a huge movie fan. And yeah, just one thing led to another. I ended up working for a producer and kind of got my foot in the door, and then it went from there.
Awesome. It's crazy how many times we've heard Scream has been the inspiration for people getting into this business. That's really cool. You know, moving on. First of all, you guys, congratulations on the success of Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey. Can I ask you guys, how did this even come about? Was this idea in somebody's head to turn a beloved childhood character into a slasher? Or did it come, you know, go into the public domain and just popped in you guys' head?
So it was definitely a byproduct of it going into the public domain. Because once we realized it was like on January the 1st, there was like some little memes going around and bits like that. And then we just had like the idea from there that it would be really fun if we made like a kind of crazy slasher version of it. And yeah, we all brought on board on it and then just ran with it.
But yeah, around the same time, I've said it quite a few times, so I worry about Matt and Reese getting so bored of me. But basically, I'd been producing a bit before Reese. So Reese had been doing like the VFX on the films and stuff like that, and he'd slowly started getting into directing. So I think Winnie was probably like only like your third or fourth movie that you'd directed on these. I don't know, something like that. But yeah, I had this like idea in my head. I wanted to make 100 films by a certain age, just because I was always like, what's my unique selling point and stuff if I ever am lucky enough to get in a room and pitch for proper money? Like, you know, what's my USP? So I was like, what if I can make 100 feature films and then I can be the guy that walks in the room? I didn't do, you know, some short film that was very successful, but, you know, I did 100 feature films. And if you give me some money, you know, I'll get the film made. So I did that. I did the 100 feature films. And then I was like, okay, right, what do I do now? And I was like, maybe if I can get this company that I was making, you know, Jagged Edge Productions, if I can get it on the map so people know some titles. So then I was making stuff like Humpty Dumpty, a bit clickbait stuff. And then Winnie the Pooh came in the domain. And it wasn't really that deep. Like, people feel like we sat there and we're like these, we want to destroy childhoods. And it's like, no, like, we just saw it and we just went, yeah, cool, we'll do that this year. And we just made it. We made like 47 films that year. and one of the films was Winnie the Pooh, and it blew up overnight.
There was, but there was definitely like an inkling with it that it was above the other kind of concepts and the other ideas we had, just because that was the one which I kind of jumped onto to direct in, because there were so many, and it was like, I just knew there was something like quite unique about that.
Yeah.
And we wanted to make sure it was kind of as good as it could be relative to the budget we had.
Yeah, but we never expected what it did.
Yeah, no, it was more like, we kind of expected it to go big, but like not anywhere near as big as it was. It was more like still kind of targeted towards more like a VOD DVD market.
Yeah.
But then it went worldwide theatrical. Who would have known?
So, talk to me some about that opening animation in the first one. It was a very nice nod to the source material, but also just absolute nightmare fuel. Can you talk about how that all came together?
Yeah, so part of that in the first film was to help the kind of transition between and like subvert what the concept was initially. So, you know, Winnie the Pooh is these old kind of sketchy style books, and it's like taking that into more of a horror direction. I thought, okay, that's a nice like transition to open it up, and also secondly is budget. It's very cheap to do scribbles on a page relative to actually filming it, so it's like you can explain a lot more with it, you can give a lot of backstory, and yeah, a lot in the first film that's actually like a lot of people's favorite part is that opening animation, and that's something both me and Matt felt as well when we watched it. So we decided to introduce that into the sequel and make sure the sequel had a kind of similar kind of vibe with the opening.
So Blood and Honey obviously absolutely blew up. There's so much support out there, as you guys know. And now suddenly we have a Winnie the Pooh Part 2 and Pooniverse, Monsters Assemble. Talk to us about the success of the first one and how that sparked and turned into what we have moving forward.
Yeah, so with the first film, obviously it was extremely like commercially successful, and especially relative to the budget, like it made like magnitudes more than what it initially cost, and because of that spawned the sequel, obviously, because you know, when something's commercially successful, it normally leads to a sequel happening. And then we thought about kind of extending this out into alternative IPs and alternative like new areas. So we had Winnie the Pooh 2, then we thought, what other concepts are there out there within this same universe kind of vibe of like changing childhoods and reimagining like kid stories. So we got drawn towards Bambi and then Peter Pan as well, and we've since added Pinocchio on there, and the recently announced kind of Pooniverse, which is going to be joining all of these different IPs and these concepts together into a bit of like a Freddy versus Jason, Avengers kind of film.
That's awesome. So let's talk a little bit about Blood and Honey Part 2 coming up here. I know you can't talk too much about it, but what can you tell us? We read it's meta to a point, and obviously that the budget is bigger because we see the rest of the Pooh crew in this one. Maybe that's a bit of an assumption. I don't know. Talk to us a bit about it.
So Matt, do you want to talk about the meta element?
Well, actually, I think, you know, honestly, I think, Scott, you should tell that story, because I think it's a really cool aspect of how you got into this whole thing. So okay. I'm happy to piggyback on it, though.
All right, cool. Yeah, so basically, so I've been producing these and I've never really acted in any of the stuff I produce. Just because it's too stressful, you end up wearing a lot of hats and stuff as a producer. So it's like it's too stressful to then be in front of the camera. And yeah, basically Ree said to me, when we got the money for the sequel, he said, you know, like, I'm going to try and restart it in a way. And he said, like, I'm going to use the first film as a film within a film, a bit like Stab with Scream. And I was like, okay, cool. That sounds good. Cause then I really want him to be able to show like what he can do as a director, you know, like the first one, it was made on £20,000, and that's really like fuck all. And the second one, like he got like, you know, people like, honestly though, that 20 grand is like, you know, that's not much. But anyway, so with the sequel, we got a, you know, improvement in the budget, and Reese basically said, you know, I'm going to get new Winnie the Pooh, new Piglet, all that kind of stuff. I was like, awesome. Sounds great. And he was like, you're going to need a new Christopher Robin. And I was like, okay, cool. And he was like, do you want to do it? And I was like, fuck. So then I was like, I was really like unsure. The main reason I was unsure is not because of Reese at all. Like, I genuinely believe in him a lot. He works so hard. But the main reason I was scared about doing it is because there is such a Marmite audience for this, and I saw what the people in the first film went through. And as a producer, you're kind of detached from it. But when you are in the film, you're in every other frame of the movie. It's like, it's, you know, it's such a intimidating thing to step into something where it's like people want to hate you and want to hate what you're doing. And I've never had that as an actor. Like, normally you get judged project by project, but this is like you're going into something that's very like fired up already. So I was intimidated, but, you know, he really sold it to me. And then when he got Matt on board, I was like, yeah, defo. Like, this would be really, really cool and stuff. So, but yeah, it basically, the first film exists within the second film. It's basically, the events did happen. So you start the film, Christopher is, you know, undergoing a lot of trauma from what happened a year ago. And yeah, as I say, the events of the first film did happen. But the first film, it is, you are watching the B-movie version of it. And then now you meet the real characters. Hopefully that summed it up.
Matt, you want to piggyback off of that?
No, I mean, that's exactly okay. It. I think, like, I remember the day. So it's funny, when I first started, I don't think that was the concept that we were going to necessarily do, Reese. Like, I think we started developing it. And then I remember we were already, like, pretty far along with the script. And you were like, hey, I had this thought. And I loved it because it does allow you to like wipe aside the mythology or any sort of like, you know, anything from the past, that it allows you to sort of create sort of fresh. And I love that idea because it owns what the first one is and utilizes what, you know, what's cool about it, puts it in this one and then allows us to expand upon it. So I was like all for it. I loved the idea. So yeah, it freed us up.
Yeah. We basically, we always knew when we were going into the sequel that, there were certain elements we needed to change relative to the first film. So, for example, like the looks of Winnie the Pooh. Everyone wants prosthetics on there instead of a singular piece. We only had that singular piece for budget reasons. And it also was tonally going into a more like grounded, serious route. So for that, we wanted to make Winnie look scarier. And eventually it kind of culminated that we were changing so much in number two relative to number one. That's where the idea of just essentially putting number one within the universe of number two kind of made sense. So it's kind of different to, you know, like Stab within Scream, because within Stab within Scream, it's not the film. Yeah, like it's not like Scream 1 going into Scream 2 or something, whereas this is literally Winnie the Pooh 1 going into Winnie the Pooh 2. So in a sense, the real events of what happened to Christopher, which Winnie the Pooh 1 was based on, no one's actually seen that yet. It does create a lot of really interesting ideas for the films to follow, though, because now both the Winnies, the Winnie from number one, 1.0, and the new Winnie exist within the same world. So theoretically, they could meet. And that would be an incredibly fun scene. So I want to try and make that happen at some point.
That's awesome. And that's actually a very perfect segue into the next question. So we've talked, my co-host and I, we've talked on air and off about the state of horror in general and basically the lack of originality. I may have harped on it more than others, sure. But I think that's why this Pooniverse has been so successful and well-received by the fans. I think people want originality, and you guys have given it to them. Speak about that some. Like, what's your stance on that? And are we on the right track?
Yeah, I'm glad you guys see it as being original and creative as well, because we do too. A lot of people seem to be saying to us that it's unoriginal and they're going, oh, you know, it's just an IP being taken and manipulated. But it's like, in our mind, it's way more original and way more creative than doing the eighth installment of a franchise which has been going for like 20 or 30 years. And that's exactly what we want to do. So we're trying to introduce all of these new concepts. We're trying to really go out there and take big risks with what we're doing. So in Winnie, for example, and in our follow-up films, we're not sticking to like a typical mold or a typical structure either within the film. So there's a lot of crazy stuff which happens. Things aren't the same model as in, you know, you've got one location, you've got one contained setting, and there's a monster there, and then shit happens there. We've got like rave scenes where 50 people are getting killed, which really push the boundaries a lot. Because that's what we'd love to see as like a horror fan. And Pooniverse is like, that was born from our love of films like Freddy vs. Jason. And because all of these IPs are so segmented to different companies, a lot of them aren't able to do this. But for us, because we're creating all of these IPs under one banner, it's possible to now bring them together,
yeah.
which makes things really
It's like we're making films that, like, we are genuinely horror fans. And it's like, we're trying to make films that we genuinely want to see. And, like, for example, you'll see, like, references to Freddy Krueger in our Tigger. And that is on purpose. Like, we miss Freddy Krueger so much. Like, it's been so long. Like, I want a character like that. So we've given elements to, like that, to Tigger and stuff like that. And you'll see it in all the characters. And, like, all the coming movies, we're kind of... We're trying to give you a little bit of, like, the certain franchises that we just don't see much of anymore. But we're trying to reinvent it as well. Like, we're trying to keep, like, to keep things fresh and new and different, but also yeah. kind of a little bit like what...
Yeah, there's sprinkles of... those kind of characters put on there. So you'll see some things which feel similar. Like with Tigger, he will feel similar at points to Freddy Krueger. Some of that's intentional, but they do have their own, like, element span on it as well. So, for example, with Tigger, one of the ideas with him is because he's essentially been caged up for so long in number two, he's very adrenaline-fueled. So you'll see there's moments where he's, like, shaking in anticipation. And we haven't seen that in many horror villains. But
that's why he's in a straitjacket and stuff.
Yeah, he's in a straitjacket. It's, like, crazy. That's a really fun, like, element to take, or, like, direction to take him. So,
yeah. Matt, anything you can add to that from the writing?
Yeah, there's also an element of just, like, doing right by fans. That was something I really appreciated with their approach. When I came on board, Reese and Scott, they had already cobbled together just, like, so much information from the internet based on comments and feedback they got on the first film. And so much of the beginning of development was, like, sort of just, like, taking all that information and people who said, like, I'd love to see this in the film. I'd love to see this. Like, we looked at all that information because Reese had already got it together. So a lot of that just went into the film. So, I mean, what was really cool is that, like, all that they're talking about, they love horror films. They do. We all do. And I think that's being put right back in and just trying to do right by fans to see things that we want to see in these films. You know what I mean?
It's a very different approach to, like, probably what most things are like, or the studio approach, where I guess it's a lot of execs in a room. We're really trying to engage people a lot more. And like Matt said, I had a 20-page document of, like, all comments and ideas and bits like that.
Yeah.
And obviously not everything can fit, because the film would be an absolute mess if you, if you try to just force in all these different tones and all of these different, like, crazy scenes. But amongst them, there are elements which do work, and then you have to see how you can kind of make a solid film with all of these elements sprinkled in, and making sure it's got, you know, the cool prosthetics, making sure it's got loads of really fun death scenes, making sure there's more characters in there and Tigger's in there.
Awesome.
Dude, I'm fired up. Eric Redding's going to love Tigger as Freddy Krueger. Hell yeah, that's awesome. So we got the director, the producer, and the writer. So I got to ask you guys kind of a behind-the-scenes type of question. Maybe I'm wrong in saying these movies from pre- to post-production seem to be coming very quickly. Can you guys tell us about the work behind the scenes that not only a movie needs anyway, but how to turn around one so quickly? Is that intimidating?
No, I was going to say, so I can jump things off with this. So I can talk about how long the development and script process took, and then maybe you guys can take it from there with, like, what went on from that point. But for as far as development, once I came on board and me and Reese kind of started to sit down and talk about ideas, it took us about a month to flesh out an outline. And that was, like, a 20-page document that had, like, basically every single scene in the movie laid out as it will in the script. And then I went to start writing. So writing a rough draft took me a couple of weeks. I did a polish pass. I think I had a script to Reese within a month that was, like, polished and ready for him to take a look at. Him and Scott had notes. We kind of had various conversations at that point where we adjusted different things for tone, for, you know, voice of character, for the arc of these characters, all these other different things. And I think it was probably, like, a few more weeks. So I think from, like, soup to nuts, there was, like, almost 3 months between when I came on board and when it was sort of like prep was starting, if I'm not mistaken. Does that sound right, guys?
Yeah, it sounds about right. Yeah. Yeah, it's like, it's not as intimidating to us as it maybe is to other filmmakers, just because, like, prior to this, we have been working fast and we've been making a lot of, like, smaller budget productions. So working at that sort of speed was kind of, it was actually a lot slower than what we're used to, but it's needed, because the idea for us going forwards with these, with going with like Pooh 2, and even this will happen even further with Pooh 3, is to just really make sure we're like spending time and making sure the story's right, making sure all of these elements are working well, the creatures look cool, we're getting good locations, getting good actors, and it's going to matter more and more as the budgets go up and up.
Yeah. I mean, I was like blown away when we finished the script. I looked at these guys and I was like, I have no clue, because I knew what the budget was. And I was like, I have no clue how you guys are going to film this, because honestly, it was like, this is like, you know, a $5-10 million horror movie script. And I'm like, here you go. Now what? Like, and the fact that, but you know, it goes back to what Scott was talking about, where, you know, he made 100, you know, these guys made 100 films before they were whatever years old, which is bananas. You know, like, it's just, they have so much experience. So they were able to pull every favor, like pull out every trick, figure everything out. And they really achieved something special here on like a really small budget that is pretty mind blowing. Like when I was done with the script, I was like, I don't know how they're going to do this. So. They pulled it off.
And we're hoping if when people see the film, we've had very good, like, positive reactions so far. And assuming this goes well on the theatrical release on the 26th, the idea is to just, you know, like, keep progressing and keep getting bigger and bigger. And we really want to show people what we can, like, actually do on, like, 2 million or 3 million, because I think it'd shock a lot of people. I think people would be really happy.
Oh, absolutely. I can imagine. You kind of just piggybacking off of that, and your answers to this may not even have anything to do with just how you guys answered that last question. But what do you guys have in the works that you can talk to us about? Anything that you can share? Or?
So in terms of films coming up, Bambi's already been shot. We've got Peter Pan in a month, which Scott will be directing. And then following that, we'll be going into Pinocchio. And then after Pinocchio, it's like a bit of a way up between whether we go straight into Winnie Free or we go into Pooniverse. I'm thinking, based on the reaction online from Pooniverse, that's probably the direction we're going to go into, is go straight into that. But next is Peter Pan.
Yeah, and Peter Pan is one that I'm directing. And what we try and do is, like, with Bambi, for example, we bought a really, really talented UK director called Dan Allen. If you see his short films on YouTube, you'll really get a sense of him. He's truly special. And I've known about him for a while and stuff. And me and Reese, we work with the same people a lot. So, like, once we have a team or we like someone, like, they get used quite, like, a lot. And it's because we like to work with the same people, because you kind of get this short thing, like, where you can kind of just, you can talk, you know, there's no, like, please, you know, blah, blah, blah. You just go, oh, let's just do this. Do you know what I mean? But anyway, yeah, with Peter Pan's Neville and Nightmare, that is coming up next. You've got, Tinkerbell, who thinks that heroin is pixie dust, so that'll be quite fun, very different. You've got it was like so easy to make it a horror film, you know, because it's just like Peter Pan going into kids' bedrooms at night and saying, I'm gonna take you to Neverland. It's so creepy. But yeah, I'm like a massive fan of like French cinema, and Switchblade Romance, which I think is called High Tension in the US, is one of my favourites. So I'd say Peter Pan is going to be a mix between that and The Black Phone.
Okay.
Yeah, you follow like Wendy, and she's trying to track down her little brother who's gone missing, called Michael. And obviously Peter Pan has got hold of him. But yeah, I think it's going to be really, really dark. I don't know if it'll be as fun as Reese's, because obviously you are dealing with children getting abducted. So naturally I went into like tonally a really dark world of this. And then Bambi is kind of like a bit of our Cujo, isn't it, really? Like,
yeah, I'd
say annoying.
I'd say, like, tonally, neither of us directed Bambi. That was Dan Allen.
Yep.
But tonally, it probably sits somewhere in between Pooh and Peter Pan. It's quite nice, I think, that these films all have a different kind of vibe and a different tone to them.
If one's not for you, the next one might be. Like, they're all tonally going to be different. And then when they get to the Pooniverse, it will make sense, because what they're going to bring to the table will make sense, because we the Pooniverse is like something that we've thought about for a while. So before these standalone films introducing these characters were even come about, it was like we had this big idea. We were like, we want all these characters in it. Who do we introduce along the way? Who's important to introduce for this universe, wasn't it? So
yeah,
awesome. Matt, what you got working on?
I directed a film last year called Don't Open the Door that is hopefully coming out later this year, that I also co-wrote with my frequent writing partner, Stephen J. Smith. We have another project that we wrote and are set to direct that we're hoping shoots later this year, but we're still sort of in the process of trying to attach talent and different things like that. But yeah, a lot of stuff hopefully coming out this year and next year. And hopefully awesome. Working with these guys some more.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, sounds like you three make a great team from what you've told us so far. All right, so Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey 2 hits theaters March 26th. Anything else you guys would like to tell the fans where they can find and interact with you guys when you're not making movies?
I think in terms of, yeah, it's coming to the US on the 26th, 27th and 28th. And that'll be via Fathom Events, but it's showing in like 1500 screens. So it should be available basically everywhere in the US. So
good.
Yeah.
I'll peek behind the curtain. I was upset when the first one came out because I went to the theater the day after and they said it was a 1-day showing and I was like, oh, so I missed it. I had to wait for it to, you know, release, but you know, I made it happen.
Oh, yeah. That's cool.
Yeah, guys. Y'all want to shout your social medias out or something?
Yeah, sure. My Instagram is ScottChambers_ and Reese.
Mine's Reese_Freak_Waterfield.
Something like that,
I think. I'm not a social media guy, but I think that's it. Yeah.
I'm at Matthew G. Leslie on both Instagram and Twitter. So
nice.
Or
nice.
X. Sorry.
Yes. Guys, we really appreciate your time. It's been awesome. And I want to ask y'all a question like off the script. And if y'all don't want to answer, that's fine. We can cut this or whatever. But I'm just genuinely curious. You know, me and Dustin, we do this show and we have a lot of fans. But we also get, you know, some negative feedback. You know, I've read several Apple podcasts that say, you know, I'm monotone, I'm boring, blah, 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 blah. I just want to know from your guys' point of view, you know, if you look, you know, just on, you know, Facebook groups, you know, YouTube videos, some of your movies get a lot of criticism, but a lot of people love them. How do you guys handle the criticism? Like, oh, that sucks. It was stupid. I liked it. I had fun with it personally. You know, how do you guys handle the criticism as filmmakers?
Yeah, I'd say there's, particularly in Pooh 1, it's a very Marmite-y film. And we have a group of people who absolutely love it. But then we do have a big pool of people who just seem to love to hate it. And you kind of have to put up a bit of a wall, I'd say. Like, I've done that a little bit from the first one, and I'm just like brushing it all off. You know, like, we had all the bloody Razzie stuff happen recently as well. And I remember with that, I was unsure about how to feel about it, because I was like, on one hand, it's massive. Like, they only have Hollywood level films, and the pool of directors in there are people like Michael Bay and all of these people. But on the other hand, it's like you are getting put up for some quite dubious awards, and the film was made on absolutely nothing. So it's very like, in terms of my career, like, I'm actually still very early relative to where I hope it will be, because I've only really been doing this for like 2 or 3 years, and I'm hoping people will see like a giant jump up in number two relative to one. So I was really like unsure about that. And I've kind of kept my distance from it a little bit. And I think that's the most like healthy approach with it, to be honest.
But I will say Reese has got such a thick skin, and it's something that I honestly strive to be like, because we're very different. Like, it actually affects me sometimes. Like, sometimes there's only so much of this I can read, like, because he gets death threats and stuff, and it goes above. Wow. I think, like, yeah, like, honestly, it's disgusting. Like, some of the stuff, it's not actually even funny. Like, the stuff that he gets sent, it's really disgusting. But it's like with me, it's like I think it actually does affect me when I'm scrolling through the Twitter. And do you know what's really, really like shocking to me is when you actually go anywhere near sites like Bloody Disgusting or something like that, it's the actual hate on those websites, not from the people that are running the websites, but the comments, is so shocking. Because as the horror community is so great, but it's like when you actually go near these big horror websites, I actually cannot believe it. Like,
yeah, I think it's a shame. Like, for us, is like, yeah, I think you have to, first of all, I think keeping your distance from all the negative stuff is like the most healthy thing you can do, and only stay in the areas where you've got like a positive community and you've got like a good set of people. But yeah, it's very strange with like with filmmakers and certain horror people. There's a lot of people out there who have this like, they just seem to have this like toxicness or this bitterness about them.
I didn't even know this existed until we did this film.
Yeah, and you start to realize that. And I think this is why, you know, like, anyone, when they get to a certain level of, not that we're famous, but when you get to a certain level of fame, you know, they all seem to like keep the distance from a lot of this stuff, and they choose not to read. Like,
yeah, people say don't read reviews, but it's like it's so hard because you know how hard your team worked. Like as a producer, I know how hard you worked. I know how hard they all worked. So I want to read. I want to find the good stuff. I want to be the one that sends them the good stuff, so they don't have to read any of the negative stuff. Because we don't have anyone that does this for us. Like, I think it's really important to find someone, if you can, who's not attached to whatever you're doing, whether it be a podcast or, you know, whatever it is you're doing, and let them kind of sieve out the nice comments, because there will be great stuff out there that makes you feel much better and stuff. But, you know, obviously for these guys, I was the one that was doing that, and I was having to go through all this stuff to find the nice stuff. And just difficult, isn't it?
And ultimately what you're doing with filmmaking is it's to entertain people. Like, that's the end product, like, that's the end goal with it. What people, like, not all films are targeted to everyone in the world. Like, that's why genres exist. People have different areas and different, like, subgenres and what they love. We're making this film for a certain pocket of people and a certain market. And evidently that market exists because the films are blowing up and they have such a, like, attraction to it, and it's becoming so popular. It's because a lot of people genuinely do want to see it. If they're like, even if they're a bit popcorny, and it's a shame that just because that exists and because that pool of people want to see these films, you get a completely different set of people who aren't that interested in it, start attacking and start like being negative and being toxic about it. It's like, what they should do is they should just like appreciate it, step back, and then look for the films they like.
But it's so hard, honestly. It's so, I've been doing this for 11 years, and like, that's the thing at times that I'm like, I see people go, oh, they're you know, they're in for it. You know that thing where we keep
cash
getting
grab.
Like, yeah, cash yeah, grab. Yeah, thanks, Matt. It's like, oh, it's a cash grab. It's like, it's really not. Like, I've been doing this for 11 years. Like, I was just trying to get my company on the map, which obviously I've been successful in doing. And then people going, oh, look, here they are with another one. It's like, but it just works. I do have projects that I have on my desktop right now that I would love to see the light of day, but it's such a struggle because people don't go and watch that type of film. Like, I've got an LGBT horror film set at a conversion camp, but the audience isn't there.
It's just the market, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just the market.
Ultimately, the market, this is what they want. This is like, evidently, you announce Pooniverse, look how bloody mad it goes. You announce an LGBT cult film. And no one cares, so it's like you have to do what is going to make, you know, help the kind of progression of the company to get to that sort of
level. And also, anyone telling you you've got monotone voice is talking rubbish. You have like the coolest voice. I'm not even joking.
I appreciate that.
Yeah,
but yeah, just like keep going. Like, as long as you keep trying, you keep progressing and getting better at what you're doing, like, eventually you will kind of get to where you want to be. Like, that's the same with, like, I'm sure that's the same with like podcasts, with filmmaking, with anything, is not to just get like beaten down and then just give up.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, you guys certainly have some supporters in us. We had a lot of fun with the first film. We're looking forward to the subsequent films, and so we're rooting for you guys no matter what.
Oh, awesome. Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, guys.
But like you guys said, it's like no one goes to your job and like writes a review on you, you know, like. It's like, I think it's ridiculous. And if you don't like it, you know, just don't watch it. Just move on with your day. There's no need to, you know, it's just people being miserable. But we really appreciate you guys' time. We're looking forward to all of your future work. We really appreciate your time, guys.
You too.
Just want to remind everybody.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.